This podcast is brought to you by DKP & Co. Chartered Accountants. You are listening to FNR Football Nation Radio.
I am Paul Mavridis, and with me as usual is Ian Syston. Ian, how are you?
I'm very good. My pinched nerve is less pinched.
That's good.
I've been doing my exercises, which is advice that I would give anybody in a similar situation. Always do your exercises.
Does that exercise include smashing your head against the screen?
Well, there is that. A great tragedy occurred during the week where I wrecked my beautiful screen by accidentally knocking it over. And so I'm in mourning.
Your apartment is the cripple apartment, isn't it?
What?
It's the cripple apartment.
I get some more light on
anyway,
the
side. Anyway. Okay. Yeah, well, that looks much nicer. Shall we start?
We can.
Clean up as we usually do. Usually we start with Mark Borich, but I'm not sure Mark has done too much this week. I've seen he's uploading some team sheets.
Yeah.
Which, you know, in terms of what Mark has achieved, is at the sort of the less substantial element. But hopefully the people who are responsible for updating things to Aus Football utilize those team sheets, and even if it's just for lower league, just put them in there. I'm sure that'll be good. George Katanas, still pumping out the interviews. I think usually every Saturday they're coming out. So he suggests you Saturday morning take your cup of coffee or equivalent and tune in. And the last thing, I mean, I get the appeal of these, a lot of these is, you know, the more famous the name, the more traction they'll get. But last week's episode with John Grimaud, you know, played a little bit of NSL, but spent most of his career, you know, Victorian Premier League and below. Yep. It was really interesting because he's also a player agent. And, you know, you get insights into Australian player development over the years that I think we don't get enough of. So there's always angles on these interviews that George Katanas does.
Well, George is a bit of a brilliant man, really, when you think about it.
Yes, he's a good interviewer. I think he's getting better and better.
Yeah. Yes, he is. I've been contacted by Simon Reynolds. He sent me he's a listener, and he's very interested in soccer and the inland of northern New South Wales, around, you know, Moolumbar and West, Lismore and so forth, Corakai. And he noticed in my book I talked about soccer in Corakai a little, and he said, have I got any more information? And I actually don't. So this is going to be another project to focus on that region. You did have somebody you were trying to contact, didn't you?
I had tried to contact Jeff Huxley, who created a sort of document on the history of the Moolumbar soccer scene, which is centered around one of the clubs there. That document, I've put it up on my blog. I think Mark probably has it on his blog as well. So if anyone wants to download that, it's easy to get. Yeah. My is southmelbourne.fc.blogspot. Mark's is melbournesoccer.blogspot. Look up Moolumbar Soccer. I'm sure you'll find it eventually. And I tried to contact Jeff Huxley, the writer of that document, and I haven't had no success. So again, if anybody knows Jeff, you know, send him word, because he's not responding to my entreaties, I guess.
Yeah. And you're a touring guy, so it's surprising that people don't respond as well as they might.
What do you know about Northern New South Wales soccer and inland? I mean, we're focused so much on Newcastle and, I suppose, slightly above that, but...
Yeah, really, Northern New South Wales is more culturally attached to Queensland, even though I'm probably offending thousands of people by saying that. But the relationship between Warwick and Stanthorpe, and, you know, seeps down into New South Wales. and some Moolumbah is really, I mean, you know, from being from Queensland and living a long time in Brisbane, I always saw Moolumbah as part of my region, not somewhere else. And I think that mindset rules to some extent. I'm happy to be contradicted, though.
From what I can gather, there is definitely connections between Gold Coast soccer and that kind of border New South Wales, far north coast soccer.
I'd be mad if you didn't. It'd be ludicrous, you know. It'd be like it'd be like Albury refusing to play Wodonga. No, we're in different states. I mean, that would be just absurd.
It tells you about the limitations of this sort of state-based system. I mean, it doesn't work for our sport in that regard. Go on.
In the book, I talked about Korakai, this place where they, at one point, this guy from Melbourne, I forget his name right now, he went up there and he introduced the game into Korakai, or got involved in it. And there was a team of English migrants who took over a rugby league club and turned it into a soccer club because they weren't interested in playing rugby league. The problem was, nobody else around them played soccer. So that was a bit foolish. But they ended up playing a few games, and I don't really know what happened. And, of course, the war comes along and wrecks everything.
But, I mean, in terms of those kind of state boundary kind of ideas, one of your early sort of theories was about the sort of Renmark, Mildura, Broken Hill sort of triangle. Because it makes more sense for those towns to be playing sport, any sport, against each other rather than playing against Adelaide or Melbourne or Sydney.
And again, you know, the borders of New South Wales and Victoria, New South Wales and Queensland are ripe. And whereas the border between Queensland and Northern Territories doesn't really have much.
No.
Although, there's not. Not a lot. Now, there's one more thing that I want to speak about, and we're always on the lookout, aren't we, for new avenues of research, new avenues of finding information. And in the quest to find information about a topic that's going to be, we're going to discuss in the next section, I stumbled upon an aerogram. Now, an aerogram was a very lightweight letter that you could pre-purchase, and you wrote in it, and you sealed it up using the sticky edges, and you know it could be posted very cheaply. And I remember because my mum used to send two or three a week, or every week. And you know, I don't know what happened to them, but anyway, there's probably not much soccer history in that. But this one was written from. Oh, Nippy, what's his name? Nippy, sorry, I learned my lines beforehand. Nippy Pryor, and he wrote it to Jim Leach, who was in England. So Nippy Pryor lived in Frankston, and Jim Leach lived in England. Jim Leach had migrated as a 10-pound pom to Australia, but his wife was homesick, and so they left and went back, and Jim Leach apparently regretted it. I think his wife regretted it too, which was often the case. A lot of migrants came here, hated it, went back to England, realized they didn't hate Australia as much as they thought they did, and came back again, but it cost them a fortune this time. Couldn't do it 10 pounds again. Nippy is writing back to Jim, telling him about the fortunes of Frankston Soccer Club. And I'll read from the letter. 1958 was the worst season ever, as you no doubt saw in the pools. And we dropped down. That's where I thought you'd be really excited, Paul. That here's an example of someone imagining the pools results in England being used not as a source of gambling results, but as a source of actual information for someone, for a fan. So there's a fan of Frankston in somewhere in England waiting for the pools results to see how Frankston went.
Could you explain how the pools worked?
Well, the pools were You want me to pomsplain how the pools work?
Well, look, we might have younger members of the audience who don't know what the pools are.
Well, the English soccer pools, and I think they were called soccer. No, they were football pools. They were methods of gambling where you had to select the score draws. A score draw was worth 3 points. A scoreless draw was worth 2 points. An away win was 1.5 points. And I think that was the case, or maybe 1 point. And a home win was worth nothing. And you marked various games with an X, and you could select 10 or whatever. And if you picked a heap of score draws, you tended to win a bit of money. And if you picked all score draws, you won the jackpot. It's another form of lotto. Okay, so when the English season finished, they had no results to do lotto on, so they used the Australian results. So you've got these English gamblers trying to come to terms with, you know, names like, well, what?
Hakoa,
and the Western Australian names, and, you know, because they didn't just use, you know, top leagues. They used all the divisions of Victoria.
So you can imagine some of the Western Australian and New South Wales,
yeah,
kind of names in these places, and
yeah. So it was fundamentally for English gambling, lotto type gambling. But here we have imagined a guy in England following a team out here and waiting to see the results via the pool's results. So that's kind of nice, I thought. Anyway, so Frankston had dropped down to the second division south, which, you know, they were probably equivalent to a third division or even a fourth division standard. This was much better, and last season we finished in third place, but the games were much more pleasant to watch, especially when we were so often on the winning side. So that's one of the benefits of being in a lower league. You win more games. Aware! it's hard to read. Think of how many of the players you would know. I can't think of how many of the players you would know now, except perhaps John Wren. I don't think it's John Wren. Who had a wonderful season at centre-half. Owen Piggott, who is still lumbering around whilst somebody else was relegated to the reserves. We've had a reserve team for 2 seasons now, and they have done mighty fine and are still in the first division reserve league, and they also came third. So they've got quite a strong reserve team. They've come third in the higher league, so that's interesting. They're just a heap of very enthusiastic youngsters. Somebody or other, someone went over to Dandenong and we weren't sorry. Well, he was getting a mighty swelled head. You can have all the something or other for something. Okay, so he runs out of space in the aerogram. You've got unlimited space, and he says, so I must finish saying other stuff. But the amount of information in there, I think, is quite rich, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, that's what something we've talked about before.
Yeah.
That correspondence is one of the, I mean, personal correspondence.
Yeah.
Is one of the big unknowns in terms of what we can find.
Yeah.
In Australian soccer history, we just don't know what's out there.
Yeah.
And most of these things probably haven't been digitized. You probably have all these English writers in Australia.
Yeah.
Who's probably, like you said before, who have come here, they probably take no interest in local soccer, but they're probably spending copious amounts of correspondence back home.
Yeah.
And they probably want to know how the old team is doing.
Well, I'm going to transcribe this, but what we know from this was that one player's lost form. We know that one player left the club and went somewhere else, and everybody was happy about that because he was getting a big head. Now, these adds meat to the bones.
That's colour, yeah.
Mystical history, yeah. So I'm really pleased I found that. I was really kind of excited, and so that's why I tweeted you straight away, and when you didn't respond, it really sort of was a dagger to the heart.
Broke your heart.
Yeah. So I've checked out terms like correspondence soccer, telegram soccer, writings soccer, and they're delivering. I'm finding interesting stuff. Not necessarily what I thought I was looking for, but all the same, finding interesting stuff. And I was sent to a history of North Queensland, where one of the players in the team was interned, in the local team in Innisfail, or Ingham, was interned. And you know, it's maddening. This is not really about soccer, but the number of anti-fascists, yeah, Italian anti-fascists who were locked up by, who would have probably been happy to join the Australian army and go and fight against fascists in Italy. It's just maddening how stupid. And you know, and it sort of says something about the way Antifa is painted historically. Anyway.
Yeah. Moving on to a couple more things. One of our listeners, Ewa Kanta, sent us a tweet, I think, last week about a claim made by, I think, the Sydney Churches Comp, that in the 1970s, they had the biggest football organization by participation in the subsphere. And he asked us, do we have any information on that? And I'm like, I have no idea where you would start with trying to validate such a claim.
That was Ewa Kanta, was it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Okay.
So I mean, you can try and look into it, but it's just
well
out of my personal remit.
Greg Werner would have some thoughts about that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he would.
Including Greg and Greg Stock.
Yeah, I think they're probably the guys to sort of tackle that question. It's a big claim to make.
Yeah.
And the other bit of correspondence we had was from our old friend Gary McKenzie, who suggested a topic of memorabilia and sort of collections. And he says, does this sort of commercial memorabilia, does it have historical value? He says, go to Gumtree or eBay and soccer, corporate merch, free newspaper medals, etc. predominate. Do they have historic value? And it's sort of, I mean, I've been noticing Gary talking a little bit about a lot of the match programs and commemorative things that have been coming up on eBay, for instance. And from my personal kind of research on these things, I usually look up for South Melbourne memorabilia programs, especially. And you can see usually the kind of prices they're worth. They're about, you know, anything from $5 to $25. I think most Australian match programs from club competitions are probably roughly that.
Yeah.
We sort of asked Graham McGinty, who's sort of our most recognizable sort of collector on sort of soccer Twitter. And he said, you know, because I want to talk to him about it, he says, look, my knowledge is fairly limited in this area. In my experience, it's aimed at fans rather than actual serious memorabilia collectors.
Right.
So we're talking about like commemorative medals and things like that.
Yeah.
However, if you collect everything and anything related to your club or country, then it will have an importance attached to it for your own collection.
Yeah.
Historic value will be clearer 50 to 100 years from now. The bigger concern is a lack of program and football newspapers. Mm. How will historians of future check archives from 2020? Is online material saved? That's a much bigger debate. And we've sort of talked about this on a number of occasions before. Especially with Roy Hay. His thing is, this is back before, long before the show, we had internal debates about media strategies at football federations and whatever. Mm. Yeah, it's great to have the online stuff. But in terms of a preservation and permanence perspective, print is still king. Now, there's no organized mechanism for collecting and organizing these things. The best we've got is Mark Burridge, honestly. I have my match programs and Rally Rasic, and everybody else will have their collections. And that's, if people want to share it, they share it. Mm. If they don't, they don't. They keep it to themselves. And the collections at public, at the state libraries are, for soccer, sketchy. So they might have the newspapers like a soccer action or whatever, but in terms of match programs, well, you can try your local library. They might have, you know, something might have been diligent enough, like in Frankston area, to, you know, donate a collection of that material. but you're just likely to have quite nothing.
And also, we've probably got the problem today with libraries not taking stuff, rejecting it.
I mean, I've got these supplemental match programs. I put all of them on online, for instance, you know. And my thought is, well, wouldn't it be best for that collection that I do have to be sent to a state library? And, you know, they'll take better care of it. Obviously, with COVID, it's a bit strange now, this child situation, but you'd like to think they would take them. And then anyone that wants to look at them firsthand can go. But we'll see. Yeah.
Anyway, we should go for a break because we have a guest champing at the bit after the break. So we'll meet her after the break.
Yep.
Welcome back to If You Know Your History with Ian Sison and Paul Mavroudis. And we're joined by a special guest today, Michelle Rouse, who's the treasurer of Sandringham Soccer Club.
Ian. Hi, Paul. Yes, you're all right. Thank you.
I was interested that in this day of Football Nation Radio, you still call it a soccer club. A lot of clubs have moved to football, but your club has obviously decided to stay with soccer.
I don't think it's a decision of staying with soccer. We are actually a brand new committee this year. All 12 of us are new. And it was a hot topic in the very first meeting, and it is something that is going to be reviewed. The challenge is we do have a Sandringham Football Club already in the AFL. So it is something that we absolutely are going to have to address. But obviously with COVID and everything that's happened this year, it's gone to a little bit later on our agenda.
So, Ian, I'm going to interrupt your little well-planned sort here. We should probably talk a little bit about Sandringham, the location, first. So, because, you know, people in Melbourne know what Sandringham is all about. But people from the rest of the country probably don't know. So, Sandringham is a bayside suburb about, you know, 15, 20 minutes drive southeast of CBD, right, Michelle?
That's correct.
On a good day, 20 minutes. And it's sort of middle class, upper middle class. And it's a very nice area. And as Michelle has intimated, it does have a prominent Australian rules club, which plays in the second tier, which makes researching in the 1920s and 30s for soccer in Sandringham a bit trickier, because you're looking for, you know, the Victorian Amateur Soccer Football Association, but you also have the Victorian Football Association, which is a totally different sport. And you have Sandringham's competing in both competitions.
The problem is also that you've got, when they've scanned these in Trove, they've scanned the whole article, the football article, which is kind of interesting. So they're putting soccer in the football section of the article. And so it doesn't make that distinction. That's a very frustrating problem, especially in relation to, I've noticed it today, reminded of it today with that guy Boyle. He took all those photos. I think he took 3 soccer photos. And so includes soccer in his description. So when you're looking for soccer images, you find hundreds of Australian rules images, which you have to kind of cut your way out of. And that's important in relation to Sandringham.
And part of the problem as well is because a lot of the Sandringham soccer club's relationships, there's crossover with the Brighton soccer club as well, which is the next suburb over. But there's also a Brighton football club in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. And good luck trying to find and separate the wheat from the chaff, I suppose, for that kind of situation. Michelle, have you found that an issue in your sort of look at these issues and try?
Yeah, I mean, you definitely come across that. And I'm trying to find quick ways that I can quickly work out, am I reading an article about football or soccer or a mix, or what am I doing? So, yeah, a few times. There are some articles that I actually could differentiate because it's not specific enough. But majority I have been able to sort of pull apart. But it's frustrating, definitely.
The British Association Football is one marker for the game in the 20s, which Paul noted before when we were talking that sort of British Association football gets a resurgence after soccer being used earlier in the Brighton region newspaper. I think that might be it too, Paul. Soccer was being used in the Brighton region, not so much in the central newspapers.
Yeah, and the Brighton region newspaper on Trove only goes up to about 1918, I think, on Trove. But Michelle, we've talked about this last week. Michelle sent us this letter asking about trying to find connections to the current Sandringham Club, which is founded in 1948, and are there connections to the previous clubs called Sandringham in from the 1930s, from the 1920s, and the 1910s? And Ian, you should probably take this up because we're stuck from the 1910s and it's a bit of a mess right from the start, I think.
Yeah, well, it is. So what we've got is we've got a junior team in 1911. That goes with what you found. And
but we've got to be clear about what junior
young.
Means.
Junior means second grade.
Yeah. So it's like almost like a provisional kind of club organisation.
And early in 1912, they decided to change their name to Moorabbin. And then as a Moorabbin club, being a Queenslander, I made a big boo-boo in my search here. I only put one B. So I mucked that up. But I couldn't find much from Sandringham for 12 and 13, although Moorabbin is apparently a reasonably strong club and plays a little bit. In 1914, they have a very strong second division team. So strong, it seems that they're promoted the next year, but they're poorly performed.
But do we know if that Sandringham is the same as the previous Sandringham?
Well, we don't yet. We don't. We've got to look at the name.
That's the problem because we've obviously found that the original 1911 Sandringham changed its name the next year at some point to Moorabbin. And then the Moorabbin disappears after 1913.
Yeah.
And there's a Sandringham in 1914, but we haven't been able to find yet the link, if there's any link between...
But are they changing their name back or did they a new club fill the vacuum?
And we can't seem to make heads or tails of that.
Well, this is an article from The Winner on August the 18th, 1915. And it's a general problem. It speaks to a general problem about soccer in Melbourne. Depleted teams. The call to arms is truly playing havoc with clubs in soccer circles. I have a communication before me from the Sandringham Club informing me that organisation has had to be disbanded, mainly owing to enlistments. Of the team's players, W. Wilmot and H.C. Major are already in Gallipoli, and H. Cann, Clayton, Overett, Andrews, Smith, and Stevens are in the camp, and that camp would be in Broadmeadows. Although the Sandringham Club's record in the league this season is only 3 points, which is, I think it's three draws, the goal record, 4-4, 18 against in 12 matches, is fairly good. And it is actually good. To come bottom of the table and only let 18 goals in 12 matches is kind of almost bizarre. And the argument is made here that it exemplifies the excellent goalkeeping quality of H. Bingham. And he's so important, H. Bingham, because he might be the link. He might be the missing link that takes the club all the way through.
To 1948, when Don and Les were there. Yep.
It's an open secret that the members of the Sandringham Club in general are disappointed at the non-inclusion of Bingham in the international contest at Fitzroy. Opinion being that he is equal to either Robson or Russell, and this, in all fairness, I'm told, is the opinion of the selection committee. However, the latter can be said to have done its work well and the blah-de-blah. Okay. So there you go. The Sandringham, the first iteration or the maybe second iteration of the Sandringham Club collapses in 1915 because of the pressure of the war. And in my own research, I've discovered previously 26 Sandringham players and two committee men enlisted in the armed forces. You wouldn't have even thought there were 26 players in the club at this stage. So it's like probably most of the club enlisted.
And you've got the names for those players?
I've got them all here. Two Allens and Andrews, who was killed. Orty, Baird, Bingham, Brown, Burton, Can, two Cans, a father and son, Clayton, who was also killed, Comer, Dylan, Foster, Griffiths, McKenzie, McIntosh, Mercer, Mitchell, Overett, Saunders, Smith, Stevens, Wood, Major, Wilmot.
So did Bingham, was that Harry Bingham that went?
Yep.
Wow.
H. Bingham, yeah.
Yeah.
And the committee men were Callahan and Allen. So Allen, there's two players called Allen and there's a committee man called Allen. So that's clearly a decent family connection as well. Well, is that telling you new stuff, Michelle, or stuff you?
Yeah, look, I was very excited to see the name H. Bingham come up in that list. I hadn't gone into a lot of detail early on because I was trying to create the links more recently between the 1938 and 1948. But then when I read Harry Bingham, that got me quite excited. It also got me quite sad reading the names of the number of players that did go to war. So that, you know, yeah. you feel for that.
And the two that died.
Mm.
So let me move on. So we should talk about Harry Bingham because he's a very important figure in Victorian soccer for a very long time, actually. So he's a goalkeeper. There's a fantastic article by J.O. Wilshaw from 1927 in the Sporting Globe, which talks about his whole history as a player and administrator in Victoria. So Harry Bingham is born in Lancashire in England. So he's English. He arrives in Australia around about 1914, 1915, I think, or thereabouts, and joins the Sandringham Club. Obviously, as Ian has sort of figured out, he's gone to war. And when he comes back, it's obviously there's a Sandringham Club which plays in 1922-23. But as far as I can tell, Harry's not part of that setup. He is playing for Windsor, which is one of the sort of better clubs, you would say, Ian, in the early 1920s.
Mm, yeah.
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 And Windsor changes its name to Paran. Now, by this stage, Harry Bingham has been playing soccer for a very, very long time. He played soccer back in England as well. So he represented Lancashire against an Irish sort of select. He was a champion runner as well. And that's an interesting point because we'll follow up on that in a moment. He represented Victoria in 1921, but apparently there were better goalkeepers in sort of most people's view. I think there's the N&D goalkeeper.
Robinson.
Yeah.
He, murderer.
Well, the accidental murderer, the manslaughterer. He
killer.
Was the better keeper. But partially, I think, because of the district split, you know, this ancient man, this ancient goalkeeper just keeps getting state games much later on than, you know, than perhaps he should have past his peak. So he represents Victoria in 1927, 28, 32. In 1932 as well, he gets a couple of Socceroos, what they call B-match appearances. So he plays once against Bohemians, the touring Czechoslovakian team.
When's
and
that?
Against one of the touring Chinese teams as well. So you have the district split at the time as well, I think, and that's maybe one of the reasons why he ends up representing Victoria in 1927, which is a long time after his, I assume, what his peak as a goalkeeper was.
Yeah.
And it's great because the article actually has a photo of him as well. A kind of dapper looking gentleman, I suppose you would say. But he's also the secretary of the Victorian Association from sort of the mid 1920s all the way through to, I'm guessing, at least the 1940s. So he's playing and being an administrator at the same time. So he's a very important person in Victorian soccer. In the context of, you know, the game at the time, it's a reasonably small community. It's not like, you know, the behemoth that it is now with hundreds, you know, tens of thousands of participants and nobody knows anybody. Everybody would have known Harry Bingham. Ian, you want to take it up from here?
Well, no, I think maybe Michelle could take it up here because she's clearly across the Binghams. And so that you might show us how your thinking develops. In the mid-30s, 36, the club resurrects once more or starts once more. You know, the terminology is really kind of important. Again, interrupted by war. resuscitates or resurrects or starts again in 1948, and is continuous from 1948. There's no argument there. Our question is, how far back can we legitimately take the club, which is obviously of your interest? So we've got that 36 moment. What are the sorts of things that you've been researching and thinking about in relation to your club's history?
Well, going back to Harry Bingham, I guess when I read that, I got quite excited because Don Bingham is a name that is part of the group that resurrects the club in 1947 to start the seasons in 48. He comes across from Brighton, and he also becomes secretary. He's also playing for Sandringham. And then I don't know if it's his son or anyway, Les Bingham, so I need to do a little bit more research there, is also then the junior coach. So obviously heavily involved with Sandringham. So it'd be interesting to see if there's a connection between Don, Les and Harry. And I'm assuming, I don't know how common Bingham is in the Sandringham area, but potentially not so much. So it would be interesting to see what that connection is. I can tell you that
Don Bingham certainly played for Sandringham in 1940. So he was considered a junior at the time. And there's an article in Trove on a Victorian team tour in New South Wales, which says that Don is Harry's son.
Ah, okay.
Getting more and more excited.
I love it. I love this.
At the same time as Don is playing for Sandringham in the early 1940s and the late 1930s, Les Bingham is also playing at the for Sandringham, I think, as well. So that's all on Oz football, which is really convenient for this.
So would that indicate that Les and Don are brothers, not father son?
I would say so, because cousin. Don is considered a young player. Now it could be an uncle.
Cousin.
I don't, you don't know until you actually get the actual relationship. Mm. You don't know. It could be a cousin. Obviously, go on, Ian.
What names have you seen in the mid 30s eruption? Who are the dominant kind of players there? Have you noticed much?
Paul or my
Michelle.
So obviously, I did let you know that and George Rayett was a name that stood out, that was part of the club in 1938 on the committee, and again is part of the group that sets up the club in 1947. So we found that connection, and interestingly enough, I reached out to his family, who did call me back last night. His grandson. His grandson has a box of information, but they're not actually, because of lockdown, not near it. But he sort of told me that obviously George came out to Australia, 1914, 15. He did play, I think it was for Footscray Thistle, I think. I did look it up. I can't remember the name. He moved to Melbourne. He also played representative football and had a couple of games with the Socceroos. He first married and was living in Mitcham, and then he moved to Sandringham in the 30s. So there's his connection with also becoming a committee member at that time in 1938. His grandson doesn't know a lot about his time as an administrator, but absolutely thinks that would be definitely something that he would have done. And so he absolutely is involved with the club in 1938. I do need to check if it's 39 and 40. And then obviously we go into recession because of the war, and it gets resurrected in 1947 when he is part of that as well. So
I'm going to do an Anthony Green here, and I'm willing to call it now that the Bingham and Rayett connection is enough to justify seeing the club, the 36, 37, 38 club as being the same club as the resurrected one.
I'd like to see the minutes. I'm not willing to call it so far because the Bingham connections are so strong with Brighton as well.
Yeah.
There's a couple of articles from around the time that Brighton is sort of the first two or three years that Sandringham is resurrected, if you want to use that term. We're talking about Sandringham as a new club, not as a resurrection of an old impulse even. The Sandringham connection it's almost like in tandem with Brighton, because Brighton is a very old club as well, from 1922 or thereabouts. And I think it's safe to say that the constant sort of appearances of Sandringham clubs is almost as much about people needing to play the game in that area and they can't get a game for Brighton. People moving out of the area as urban sprawl starts spreading around Melbourne. And, it makes sense. The next time I'm over, I'll start a club there.
So in a way, the history of both Brighton and Sandringham is twisted together.
Yes.
They're intricated in a really complex way. And so it might make more sense to talk about the history of both clubs.
Yes.
If you wanted to talk about continuity and flow. Yeah. Anyway, that's one way of looking at it.
I mean, even with some of these connections, is it enough to find the names? I think you have to find an organisational impulse.
What do you think,
Well, I think a few times I've heard you both say that finding that information, it's very difficult. It's not there in some cases, and unless we can find a box in someone's attic, I think it will be very difficult to find exactly what we're looking for.
Great relative has, that's like, wow. What's in
there? Yeah, he said there's not a lot, but there might be some photos and things like that. But
old green jumper with a V on it.
Yeah, possibly. But I think also the information that we're getting this from is people's opinions in newspapers. So the excitement of a new club starting in 1947 is probably a better headline than we're resurrecting an old club. So part of me, thinks, well, there is these connections. I guess how many connections do we have before we can piece it together as the potential longevity of the club? I mean, at the moment, the club only celebrates from 1948. But now we've found George, there's a clear connection to the club that closed, that went into recess because of the war. And so it'll be interesting to see how many of the players in World War II went.
What I found with the Newcastle experience is that often players enlisted and they stuck together as players, and they played during the war for teams, battalion teams and so forth. And I guess because Newcastle was had a very regimented battalion system, the players could stay together. And so it's almost a continuity in the armed forces. And so what I'll be trying to look at myself is the continuity that might exist with the Sandringham players in the armed forces. And there's one player that we've talked about is Drakup. Have you come across him, Michelle?
No, not yet.
Because he's a mystery to me. Paul, what do you know about him?
So we know, for instance, that George had played with Melbourne Thistle, and Melbourne Thistle is suspended in 1935 for not fielding a reserve team. It seems like a very onerous punishment. And at least some of these players will have to try and find other clubs. Now, Drakup is one of those players. He's played for Melbourne Thistle, and all of a sudden he's not there anymore. There's no club. He joined Sandringham.
Well, maybe George gets in. Maybe George says, come along and play.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Now, there are, as far as I can tell, there are what appear to be service records in the National Archives for Jack Drakup. And it's a very unusual surname. It's not a very common one. I think it's a Scottish surname.
And George was Scottish, so yep. There might be a relation there.
Yep, the whole Thistle Club was a kennel full of Scots. So Draca ends up, I think, going to the war, but we have to get those records out of the archives. The war memorial, unfortunately, has almost nothing on the Draca surname. Now, we know that there is a Jack Draca who lives in Hyatt in Moorabbin area for a very long time after the war, but I don't think he appears with any Sandringham soccer connections or any soccer connections after the war, which is kind of, I think, a bit unusual for someone who was happy to switch clubs and obviously was a committed player. But in one of those weird coincidences, you do a search for Draca on Oz Football, for instance, and you find an Amy Draca who plays for Sandringham women's team in 2009. And you're thinking, okay, there's probably, skipping several generations here, but that's such an uncommon surname. There must be a family connection. It just, your mind automatically goes to that. And this is part of the problem with doing this research, because as excellent as Mark Borich's website is, the soccer news collection at the time that Sandringham is re-established in 1948, 47, there's not much coverage there in that era for soccer news. If you're using Oz Football, I mean, some parts are good, some parts are not as useful. And oftentimes there's broken links as well. So there's links that you can only find if you're knowing how to search on Google, because they're not on the front page. So which adds to the sort of complexity of trying to find these connections. And even for the newspapers, I mean, in the 1910s, like we said, we have this very good Brighton newspaper talking about soccer in the local area, and then there's nothing else after 1918. Yeah. So, I mean, it's... Ian and I have covered a lot in terms of Coburg and Moreland and Brunswick soccer. We've covered a lot in Albert Park, Middle Park, South Melbourne, in terms of Melbourne soccer. And we understand the impulses, we think, of what caused people to choose soccer as their pastime for those areas. What the area of Melbourne, I think, that we struggle with, we haven't really covered very much, is this whole eastern suburbs arc from Box Hill through to Moorabbin and Oakley, Brighton, Sandringham. There's this whole eastern suburbs, Camberwell, Hawthorne, whole eastern suburbs soccer scene we don't really know much about. And what drove those people to play soccer? And certainly I think part of what you're going to do, Michelle, in looking at this research is finding out what made people in this part of Melbourne play soccer as opposed to Australian rules or another sport.
Well, we're running out of time, Michelle, so sorry about that, but we'll keep in contact, and when you find more and start to make some really serious links, and we're happy to help you make those links as well, we'll get you back on.
That'd be terrific. Now, I really appreciate your support. And I guess the only other link that I've found at the moment is that in 1936, Sandringham, and this is probably creating the connection between 1936 and 48, is that Sandringham was allocated the Castlefield Oval as the training grounds from council. Now, we have a Castlefield tournament every year, which has been running for as long as most people can remember. And it is because it was one of the original playing pitches for the club. So that's another connection around keeping that longevity between, at least from that period of 1936 to 40, then again from 1948, 47 onwards. So...
Two more things before you let you go, Michelle. Also, the grounds issue is a really important one, because obviously the Sandringham Soccer Club use a number of different grounds, and trying to find continuity there is of the utmost importance as well. But also, there's contradictory things, like there's a Moorabbin Soccer Club item from 1978 or 81, which talks about a competition held with Sandringham over many years, and going back before the 1948 establishment of the current Sandringham Soccer Club. So that was on Mark Borich's side. which is a really interesting kind of little tidbit. I mean, you're thinking, why are they saying 60 years previous? That's out of kilter for both clubs, I think. But last thing is, people should go check out the Sandringham City Soccer Club's history page on their website. It's not the most detailed thing, but it's really interestingly presented. It's not just a slab of text. There's photos, there's a nice little checkpoint mechanism. Whoever's done that has done a really nice job, obviously with very limited resources in some sense in terms of the actual core narrative. But they've done a very interesting job of presentation. I think it's something a lot of clubs could easily do and replicate.
Oh.
FNR Football Nation Radio, and now it's time for
100 years ago today.
Just in case it didn't come over.
Very good. Ian, where are we starting this year?
This week, I have another tragedy to articulate. It's getting depressing. It's the 14th of August, 1920. Sorry, the 13th of August, 1920. It's actually Black Friday. But on the 14th of August, we've got the Argus letting us know that there are 5 games going to be played on the weekend, all at Middle Park. Some of them are reserve games. 2 of them are reserve games. So do you reckon they played beforehand? Or are there 5 fields, Paul?
I would have no idea. I'd assume they're not spreading the games over on Sundays as well. I mean, they've just probably played, they probably would play on the same grounds.
You're not allowed to play on Sunday at this stage in history.
No.
All right, so the results of these games are as follows. So I don't have much time to go through, but Northumberland and Durham playing against St Kilda, and St Kilda 3, Northumberland and Durham 2. That's 2 weeks in a row Northumberland and Durham have lost. It's an awful, awful situation. So Thistle 1, Windsor 1. Footscray 3, Preston 1. Windsor A 4, Thistle A 0. Preston A 4, St Kilda A 0. And I don't know where Albert Park is in all of this. There's no Albert Park game. And so if you can share the screen, Paul, and show the table.
Yeah, just give us a sec. Share the screen. Yep.
So I can't see it, but I assume that we can.
Were you looking for Albert Park?
No, looking at the Premiership list.
Yeah.
Yeah.
St Kilda, NND, Footscray, Thistle, Albert Park, Preston, St David's.
Yeah, so you can see there that St Kilda are now leading by 4 points. And that was a 4-point game, St Kilda and Northumberland Durham. It could have been level had it been a draw. And you see the 4 and against is very similar as well. What's great, this all's coming up close, yeah. Yep. And yep. Albert Park is the only one other team in contention, but Preston and St David's are nowhere. And Section B is looking a bit closer, although Welsh don't look very good. All right, so I'll move on. If I can get my mouse to work, I'll move on. Okay, Daily Telegraph in Launceston. Soccer. A possible versus probables match will be played on York Park tomorrow, from which the final selection of the representative team to meet the Southern team will be selected. So I put this up yesterday, to which Paul Hunt responded by saying, what, no good news from Hobart this week? So it's great to think people are getting angry when the area is not selected in 100 years ago today. But we're going to focus on that game next week. There'll be a report on that game, and so we'll look at that next week, the Southern versus Northern. Who do you reckon wins that, Paul?
The North.
You reckon the North win?
Why not?
Have a little bet?
No.
Okay. Here we've got the St. George call on the 14th of August. And here's an echo down the ages. If it was not for the absence of soccer grounds, the game would certainly get a stronger grip of our sporting fraternity, as it is only by playing the game in their midst that we can educate them in the finer points. Now that Ramsgate and Schofield Park have been closed down for business reasons, the only remaining ground where competition matches are played on is on the outskirts of Hurstville. And losing Schofield Park, it may be to the betterment of the players, as in travelling from one goal to the other, many little mounds that covered the ground were veritable death traps and endangered the lives of the players, and often when trodden on would give way under their weight. So that's an interesting point, that they're struggling for space to play in the St. George region in Sydney in 1920. And it's a complaint that comes down through the ages. And I'll just leave it at that again, because we're getting very close to time. This one's the Cumberland Argus and Fruit Growers Advocate. And it's there's a whole series of things about match reports. There's this match report where it looks at every player and what he did. So I won't read that out, but I've got these bits. A question over which there is a good deal of argument in soccer circles is the advisability of playing men in positions they are not accustomed to. So here we've got theoretical discussions in the newspaper. Quite a number of critics and sound judges of the game are of the opinion that it is not wise. Quite obvious, of course, that if players occupy the same position week after week, they are certain to work out for themselves, and so on and so forth. Why is this interesting? You know,
I know, you tell me.
While they're fighting for space on the ground, they're clearly not fighting for space in the paper, because this is just on and on and on.
Mm.
Players get to know each other's style, their partner's little weaknesses or idiosyncrasies, and the exact pace of his colleague. I mean, really? Okay, should an English team visit Australia next season? Much more interesting. Junior players will have splendid opportunities gaining many points and wrinkles. What's a wrinkle?
Foible.
No, gaining. Okay. So the special council meeting of the GNDFA, the Granville and District Football Association, met on Tuesday to decide the appeal of Auburn Federals against the management committee's decision in awarding their match against Two Blues, which was stopped by the referee W. Knight for rough play to Two Blues. Mr. Reardon was in the chair. A large amount of interest was displayed by the various teams and delegates. Mr. Kelly, in supporting the appeal, contended that there was rough play only on the part of one player, Drury, and that player was sent off the field. A policeman was present on the date in question. He saw no rough play other than one little scrap-up. Several others supported the motion. Referee Knight, in upholding his action and stopping the match and the management committee's decision, stated that the game was an orgy of brutality on the part of most of the federal players. His object seemed to be to cripple the opposing players. The motion was put to the meeting and was defeated 12 votes to 10. I thought that was interesting, because it's like, you know, it's certainly not a gentleman's game at this point, is it?
No.
It's quite a brutal game when some teams play. So here's another little interesting snippet. All matches are to be suspended today to enable players to watch the interstate match. And then Wanderers rugby football team applied for the use of Clyde Oval for a match against a visiting team from Millthorpe on 8-hour day. The request was refused, as the ground is engaged on that day. So is soccer behaving like, you know, I don't know, AFL?
I mean, the thing about the violence of the game is, I mean, it's so contradictory.
Yeah.
Not from an outsider's point of view, because that's a whole other kettle of fish, but I mean, you see so many Victorian articles, for instance, talking about it's a safer game. That's the soccer people saying this. It's a safer game for young men to play.
Yeah. There's nothing safe about the way that game's described.
No. And that's part of the curiosity you get when you're looking through these articles at the same time. I mean, they're contemporary articles.
Yeah. I mean, often when people said, when people talk down soccer, it's often when they talk it down with that much experience. But and the soccer people are talking it up for being less dangerous, when they know, in fact, that they're gilding the lily.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay, so in The Age, on Monday the 16th of August, we have this. interstate matches, Sydney. Three interstate football matches between New South Wales and Queensland took place in Sydney on Saturday. This is kind of interesting. It's just a bit coincidence. They were respectively a rugby, a soccer, and an Australian rules match. New South Wales was victorious in all three games. In the rugby match, the final scores were New South Wales 40, Queensland 18. In the soccer match, New South Wales scored 3 goals to Queensland's nil. In the Australian rules game, New South Wales kicked 9-11 to Queensland's 5-16. Geez, that's a lot of behinds, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay. And the final, that was interesting, you know, that, as we learned last week, that Sydney was the football capital of the Southern Hemisphere. And this piqued my interest because it's garbage, apparently. But it speaks to a kind of preoccupation in Melbourne, and you probably have some things to say about it, Paul. Hockey attractions from the Herald. It's the 7th of August, so it's a bit out of sync here, but I just found it. I thought I want to talk about this. Interest in game increases, probably because it attracts the player rather than the spectator. Little is heard of hockey as one of Victoria's many outdoor games. That it is becoming increasingly popular, however, is evident from the growing strengths of the weekly competition and the fact that an interstate carnival is fixed to take place in Sydney a few weeks hence. Hockey is widely played in England, America, India, and New Zealand, and if had not caught on in Victoria to the same extent as in those countries, the reason is probably due to the fact that the rules of the game follow closely along the lines of British Association football, a game little known in this state. Victorians nurtured in a school of football that knows no offside have ever been puzzled by the principle, and even experienced hockey players in the state have sometimes found themselves in difficulties with the application of it. Okay, so what do you make of that?
It's, on the one hand, it's quite believable.
Yeah.
On the other hand, we've come across references to British Association tactics.
Yeah.
We've come across references to soccering.
Yep.
In Australian rules.
Yep.
So they are having, you know, the cake and eating it too. They're both unaware. Victorians are both unaware of what soccer is.
Yeah.
But they also use its terminology and its tactics.
And also they completely know that it's not a very good game.
Yes.
Yeah. But something else is going on here, and it's basically saying Victorians are too stupid to understand the offside law.
There's a bit of that.
It's like, it's a pretty simple law when you're playing.
As long as you've got the salt shakers and the pepper shakers.
Yeah.
And the glasses.
Yeah.
We've gone over time by a mile here, but we have actually something that came up during the week, actually yesterday, and it's related to this. Was an article in the Monthly, which you took umbrage at, about the current NRL is boss, Peter Volandis.
Landis? I didn't
think that. Whatever it is. And it's a interesting in terms of, it talks about class a lot in rugby league. It means sort of historical kind of positioning within Sydney culture.
And migration.
And it talks a lot. It's a very gushing piece, so you have to take that with a grain of salt. But what's missing from it, Ian?
Well, it's a universe in which soccer doesn't exist.
And this is kind of what this hockey article is almost, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, one's a Melbourne thing and one's a Sydney thing.
Yeah.
But in the Sydney thing, in Sydney, this article, based on a Sydney situation, rugby league, it's heartland, it's class situation.
Yeah.
You have three prominent Greek Australians discussed. So Volandis, I think the chairman of South Sydney, and Politis, who is the chairman, whatever he is, of Sydney Roosters, the East's club.
Yeah.
And not one mention of soccer.
Yeah.
Not even as a background thing, not even as the fact that Politis funded Sydney Olympic.
Yeah.
Through its last real successful period in the NSL.
Yeah.
Soccer doesn't exist.
Yeah, and the response that, well, it's not about soccer, is not good enough, because, you know, it's part of the context. It's part of Sydney's context.
Yeah, it's, I mean, they talk about rugby union quite a lot of it, and that's fine. Rugby union, rugby league nexus is important
to the context of the article. In terms of it being in competition at the high end.
Yeah, but there's no, I mean, there's talk about migration, a lot of it.
Yeah.
And let's talk about the backgrounds to a certain extent of the three Greek guys, at least.
Yeah.
And there's no mention of soccer. You know, considering soccer is also very much a working class. I mean, it's not a middle class game in Sydney as well. It's across class lines now. But a lot of it wouldn't working class in the past. There's no mention of it. The game doesn't exist. The game that never happened.
Game that never happened.
And it's still not happening.
It's time to go. It's time to go. It's time. I'm going to stop talking about this game that never happened.
Yeah. All right. Hope you enjoy the show. We'll see you next week.
I really enjoyed having Michelle on. I think it's going to be some terrific stuff coming out of that. So let's fingers crossed, and we'll see how the future goes.
Yep.
See you next week.
See ya.